Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco at our new building, 110 Embarcadero. And I'd like to also welcome our radio and online audiences. Well, tonight it's my great pleasure to introduce Jeremy Lent, who's going to speak to us about his research and his book called The Patterning Instinct. He's also the founder and executive director of the Liology Institute. Li, coming from the Confucianist idea of order, and ology from the Greek on how to study something. So combining both Eastern and Western thought, which is part of his way of dealing with things. Well named. Thank you very much for coming, Jeremy.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks for being here today. And before I get going, I'll actually just begin, as George said, with this 2.5-minute book trailer, which I think has is a great way to just kind of frame what the themes of the book are about. And then I'll give a talk where we'll kind of take one particular lens to explore it in some more detail. So I'll just begin with a trailer, and then we'll go from there.
So the human patterning instinct is what's responsible for all the benefits of our civilization. Yet somehow, that same uniquely human instinct has brought us to this precipice. I went through a period of my life when I asked myself, where does meaning come from? I refused to just accept what I was told. I wanted to find out for myself where these ideas about the cosmos came from. So I kept peeling the onion, going further and further back in history and different parts of the world, all the way back to humanity's origins. And I began to realize that what makes us unique is that we're driven to pattern meaning into the universe. And the patterns of meaning different cultures choose shape their values and the part they play in history. So the values our global civilization is based on, capitalism, consumerism, conquering nature, are not preordained. They're the results of ideas we've inherited from previous generations. So we might ask, what do these patterns hold for our future? A techno-utopia? A collapse of civilization? Or could we consciously change those patterns of meaning and together create a more harmonious world, a future of sustainable flourishing?
Okay, great, thanks. So I'll just turn that, close that. And thanks, and also you can see from that framing that so much of the book is about these patterns of meaning that cultures create out of the universe and how that changes how their values are and how that affects what they do as a culture, which ultimately shapes history. And I wanted to start off today by just kind of noting that obviously it's Columbus Day today, and that feels like a particularly appropriate way to sort of feel into a really core theme of what this book is about. Because, you know, as we know, Columbus Day is celebrated really with a long history now in the United States. We've got parades, barbecues, football games, all that kind of stuff. And I think if we just take that and begin to explore a little bit about why we celebrate that and what it actually means, it kind of will give us a little bit of a hint for a particular pattern of meaning that I see is framing our current civilization, which has an impact to really not just where we've come from, but where we might be headed, and how understanding that a little bit better might actually enable us to affect where we go as a civilization. So the book itself, as you probably just saw, got a sense from that trailer, and it really covers this huge span from early hunter-gatherer times to the modern world. So it's kind of hard sometimes to figure out where can we focus to get a sense of the book. But what I'd like to do is to begin with a riddle, if you will, which relates to this kind of theme of Columbus Day today. And I'll call it the riddle of Admiral Jung and Columbus. So we all know about Columbus, obviously. Pretty much every one of us can know that he set sail from Spain in 1492, and he discovered the New World. And when he did that, he had about 90 men in three threadbare boats that were barely seaworthy. In fact, a rudder on one of them broke after 3 days at sea, and they had to stop at the Canary Islands for repairs. So that was 1492. Now, almost 100 years before that, in 1405, in setting out from China, there was somebody called Admiral Zheng He, and he set sail from China with the greatest armada in history. He had 27,000 men in his armada, in over 300 ships. And these were real ships. You could actually fit 10 of Columbus's boats in one of his major ships. Like, there was that difference in technology. And he went on 7 long voyages for over 28 years in total. And he basically owned the Indian Ocean. He went to places like Sumatra, Sri Lanka, all the way to Arabia, and all the way down to East Africa. Wasn't a spot really where he couldn't go to. And he had this amazing power and control. So the riddle is, why do we know about Columbus? And why, barely, unless you're a Chinese historian, do we not even know about this Admiral Zheng He? Why isn't it called Zheng Day rather than Columbus Day? Well, some historians, and more recent modern historians, have basically looked at that question and answered it with an approach to history that's often known as a geographical determinism. And they say, well, it's simple. It's not that Europe was so special or anything like that. It's simply that Europe was closer. And so Europe got there first. And if the Chinese had gotten there first, then yeah, the whole of history would be totally different. But my approach that I've taken in this book, and then I'll take us through today, is that actually that's not the case. That even if Admiral Zheng had actually discovered America before the Europeans, like if the trade winds and currents had allowed him to sort of sail in the Pacific easily to just hit the New World, quote unquote, that way, that actually he would never have done the things that Columbus did, and we'd still wouldn't be calling it Zheng Day rather than Columbus Day, and that's because the kind of deeper truth that I look at in this book, in the whole book, is this notion of how culture shapes values, and how those values shape history, and the important implication of that is that the values that we hold as a society today may shape our future. And that's why this issue is not just a kind of theoretical academic issue, but it's an issue about what kind of future we as a society want to create for our descendants. So let's start off by going back to Columbus and taking a look at what happened when he landed. So he landed, we think, in the island that's now known as Hispaniola. And he was amazed by what he saw as kind of the innocence of these native people he came across. And we know exactly where his mind was at because he wrote in his journal quite some detail. So one important passage we see from his journal when he first got there is he writes, and I'll quote, he writes, "They are so artless and free with all they possess that no one would believe it without having seen it. Of anything they have, if you ask them for it, they never say no. Rather, they invite the person to share it and show as much love as if they were giving their hearts." So sweet, right? But Columbus doesn't stay in that place for very long. His mind starts wandering to other thoughts. And then very shortly later, he's writing a letter to Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. And he writes, "They do not bear arms, and they don't know them. For when I showed them a sword, they took it by the edge and cut themselves out of ignorance." And then he goes, exploitation. He goes, "They would make fine servants. Should your majesties command it, all the inhabitants could be taken away to Spain or made slaves on the island. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want." So this is the mindset we see. And, you know, people say, well, Columbus was just like other people of his time. You know, don't get so down on him. And there's actually a lot of truth in that, that the people, the whole mindset of the wave after wave of European, first the conquistadors and then other settlers who came to North and South America, had a similar approach of really what we might call ruthless exploitation. Just the explorers, they were concerned about how can we enrich ourselves? How can we pay back and enrich the people who just financed us? And as we know, the result was really the greatest genocidal catastrophe that has occurred yet in human history. Basically, everywhere the European explorers went, there was followed by this decimation of the local population in unimaginable proportions. You know, and it helps you just look at some numbers to get a feeling for what we're talking about. When Columbus first arrived, yeah, there at 1492, the population of central Mexico is estimated at being roughly 20 million people. And that was four times greater population than Britain had at that time. Within a century, there were fewer than a million people alive there. Yeah. Similarly, same thing in the Inca Empire in South America. They were estimated to have about 11 million people there before the Europeans arrived, and less than a million 100 years later. And it's been estimated that in that century alone, the 16th century, close to 100 million indigenous people died in the Americas through a combination of slaughter, starvation, and disease. Just such enormous proportions. Now, many historians have looked at that and said, yes, but you know, we've got to look at the diseases the Europeans brought. That was the thing that really made the difference. That's what ravaged the populations. And some historians will even go so far as to say, you know, it was an inadvertent catastrophe. It's like a sad but inevitable consequence of human progress. This is just what happened because the indigenous people were not, you know, they didn't have immunity to the Eurasian germs and everything else. And while there is no doubt that those diseases played a huge impact in causing havoc among the people of North and South America, and some historians who've looked at this in detail, a couple that I'd name, David Stannard and Eduardo Galeano, two great historians, have really excruciatingly documented how at the same time the Europeans did approach this sort of new world with a systematic compulsion to exploit everything they could remorselessly, both human and mineral. Their approach was to just ransack the land, make up the rules of the game as they went along to exploit whatever they could. And what I discovered as I did the research for this book, for The Patterning Instinct, was that this obsession with sort of exploitation, we've come to accept as, well, that's kind of the way the world works. That's normal human behavior. Let's face it. And actually, it was unique to the European mindset among all other cultures that existed in earlier times. But because that's now become the predominant global mindset, we just take that as a given. We don't even really question that that's kind of what happens. That's the way the world works. So what's interesting about that is that, you know, when we don't look at these underlying values, we kind of think that the direction of history is somehow inevitable. But when we start to look at how values affect history, we begin to see that actually what happened in history was a consequence of a particular way of thinking that arose only in Europe. So to get a sense of where what I mean more by that, let's turn back to old Admiral Zheng He in that early part of the 15th century. Well, he had all the power that he could possibly want. In fact, he left such a fine impression in some parts of where he landed, he was deified. And they actually made him into a god. And even now there's temples where you can actually see an image of Admiral Zheng as a god that people worship. He had that much power. His ships inspired awe wherever he visited, which is not surprising when you consider that his 27,000 people were more than the entire local population of many of the places where he landed. And he wasn't afraid to use his military might when needed. When there was piracy, he would suppress it. And sometimes he was friendly with a local politician and he'd use his power to influence the local politics. So he could have, if he'd wanted, he could have enslaved the populations. He could have mined the mineral wealth. He could have entrenched, you know, China's wealth, have this massive Chinese empire all through every part of the Indian Ocean. Instead, what did he do? He set up embassies in China's capital, Nanjing, and he would bring emissaries from Japan, Malaya, Vietnam, Egypt, Africa to China and treat them with respect. And the idea was to sort of show the prestige of the Middle Kingdom, of what China was, to let the rest of the world know what a humane and advanced place China was in the world. So we can see how the cultural values that different cultures have can really shape history like that. It would have been as unthinkable for Zheng to have conquered and enslaved those societies he visited with his armada as it would have been unthinkable for Columbus to have set up embassies with the indigenous people in the New World. I mean, imagine Columbus saying, oh yeah, look, we should bring some of these native people back as ambassadors to Spain. Just totally unthinkable. So what was this kind of value system that Admiral Zheng came from? So in China, the predominant aim of political power was to sustain a society's equilibrium. Like the use of military force was seen as something you do when it's necessary to maintain stability. And they applied that same thinking to their approach to natural resources, much to the bemusement of the early missionaries who went there from Europe. There's this fascinating note that is written by one of these missionaries called Jean-Baptiste Duhald, who is mystified why they failed. The Chinese were failing to mine all the gold and silver in some mountains that were close by. So he wrote in his journal how he says, the Chinese say the mountains are full of gold and silver, but that the working of them has been hindered from some political views that the public tranquility might be disturbed by the too great abundance of these metals, which would make the people haughty and negligent of agriculture. So it's so fascinating to see this kind of window on these traditional Chinese ideas with this almost like this puzzled understanding from Europe. So the traditional Chinese view of power was what they called the mandate of heaven. The emperor was assumed to have the power to rule because he was given the mandate by heaven. But they would only endorse the emperor if he ruled responsibly. And what's fascinating is the Chinese word for the word govern and care for is the same word. It comes from the same root. Meanwhile, the European view of power was to basically disrupt any equilibrium and to look at that as a way that actually has a value in itself, that it's a good thing to do. And we can see that actually if we can go all the way back, way earlier than Columbus or the sort of more modern European history. We can see something that is unique to Europe that again is different from any other culture in the world. So it's not just Europe versus China. It's Europe with this kind of different mindset than we see in other indigenous cultures. So let's go all the way back to Alexander the Great. And we know, you know, some of the great stories how he had this amazing empire in just a few short years, went all the way to as far as India, as far as the edges of the known world, and formed this great empire. And there's this fascinating story that's said about Alexander that some of you may know, and it's the story of the Gordian Knot. So this story is about how there was an area in the Middle East called Phrygia, and these Phrygians were without a ruler once, and their oracle prophesied the first person to enter the capital in an ox cart would be their next king. So it just so happened that a peasant called Gordius entered the capital in this ox cart. He was made the next king. So he was so grateful, so he dedicated his cart in gratitude to the gods, and he tied its shafts to a post in this elaborate knot. And the oracle prophesied whoever undid that knot would become the king of all Asia. But no one had ever succeeded in undoing it because it was tied together in this special way where there were no ends to work, so you just couldn't get at it. So Alexander came there and he heard this, his legend said, okay, I'm going to get that knot. So he came up with a devastating simple solution. He drew his sword and sliced the knot cleanly in half. And as the oracle predicted, he went on to become the ruler of Asia. So in this case, what's so interesting is nobody went around saying, he was a cheat. He like broke the rules. That wasn't like the way you're meant to do it. But he was lauded for the fact that he disrupted the rules of the game. He said, I've got the power. I'm going to come up with a new set of rules. And by doing that, I'm going to take power. So again, we get this notion of disruption as being a value in itself. And what I find interesting is that around the same time as Columbus, there was another great emperor. This one was an emperor in ancient India. His name was Ashoka. And he inherited from his grandfather, Chandragupta, this empire covering most of the subcontinent of India. It was huge. And he went on to show his own military prowess. He conquered a region called Kalinga. And we know about all this because he erected a stupa, a monument, commemorating his achievement. But what's so fascinating is this is not like some commemoration that we might be expecting to see from ancient times, like how great, what a great emperor I am, etc., etc. Ashoka had recently converted to the new religion of Buddhism. And in this stupa, the inscription he wrote lamented the destruction he had caused. He actually wrote on the stupa, on conquering Kalinga, His Majesty felt remorse. For when an independent country is conquered, the slaughter, death, and deportation of the people is extremely grievous. Today, if 100th or 1,000th part of those people were to suffer similarly, it would weigh heavily on the mind of His Majesty. And he actually goes on to say, because he was believing in this Buddhist notion of Dharma as a way of life, of connecting with the universe. And he even went on to say, this inscription of Dharma has been engraved so that any sons or great-grandsons that I may have should not think of gaining new conquests. They should only consider conquest by Dharma to be a true conquest, and delight in Dharma should be their whole delight. Now you might say, okay, cherry picking, you know, we got one great emperor here, one there, but does this really show a cultural mindset of this contrast I'm talking about? Well, there's a couple of interesting things to look at that suggest that it's not just cherry picking, but these are actual meaningful examples of different ways of looking at the world. So even if we look at Ashoka, and generations before him, in the reign of his grandfather, there was a classic of statecraft called the Arthashastra that was written, sort of a little bit like Machiavelli's The Prince. It became this notion of this is how you're meant to, a rule is meant to be. But this is the kind of thing it said about conquering territory in this classic. It said, having acquired new territory, the conqueror shall substitute his virtues for the enemy's vices, and where the enemy was good, he shall be twice as good. He shall follow policies that are pleasing and beneficial by acting according to his dharma and by granting favors and exemptions, giving gifts and bestowing honors. And if anyone still questions, well, how do we, you know, really know that people actually lived according to these principles? What's so interesting is India actually had their own colonies. And in fact, we call them the East Indies because historically they had so much power and influence over that part of the world that, again, they could have done whatever they'd wanted to. They could have enslaved those populations and, like, mined their materials, etc. Instead, they actually developed a peaceful trading network that enhanced the whole cultural sophistication of that whole area. And a lot of their ideas became part of Southeast Asia that, again, only got disrupted when, in fact, the Portuguese came in the 15th, 16th century and, again, changed the rules of the game and disrupted hundreds of years of stability there. So we see this propensity of European minds to, like, disrupt, to change the rules of the game, to gain a power advantage over others. And then we can see through history how it develops. We see the slave trade, where, again, going past the Spanish and Portuguese, the Northern Europeans went, what a great opportunity here. Let's, you know, ship these slaves from Africa. We can use them to get our new crops together. 6 million people were shipped as slaves in the 18th century alone. A total of 12 million people, it's estimated, suffered, so many of them dying on the actual ships, of course, coming to the Americas. And even when abolition occurred in the early 19th century, those in power just developed new forms of exploitation using indentured labor and forced trading practices to maintain this domination over the rest of the world. So as late as around 1900 or so, you have Cecil Rhodes, famous colonial sort of magnate, if you will, who wrote in his journal breathlessly, we must find new lands from which we can easily obtain raw materials and at the same time exploit the cheap slave labor available from the natives of the colonies. He goes, the colonies would also provide a dumping ground for the surplus goods produced in our factories. He's got the whole thing worked out. This is how we're going to exploit the rest of the world. And that European mindset, that way of thinking, was applied equally to the natural world. So Francis Bacon, the prophet of the scientific age, famously said, knowledge itself is power. And he gave this clarion call to really conquer nature. He said, you know, we should establish and extend the power of dominion of the human race itself over the universe, render ourselves the masters and possessors of nature. So then, when we look at these lessons of history, and then we look at the modern world, we can see that that same way of thinking that led, say, the Spaniards, when they got to a place like Potosí in Bolivia, the biggest silver mine in the world, where they basically, they mined every last grain of it. They enslaved millions of people. In fact, probably more people died prematurely in that mountain on Bolivia than any one place in the world. It's estimated as many as 8 million people died mining that silver. So that now you can't even find a grain of it. They got every last piece of dust of silver out of that mountain. So that's the kind of way of thinking that leads today's fossil fuel companies to rape the earth through fracking, through tar sands extraction, even while we know that carbon emissions are threatening the future of our civilization. And they're looking, how can we get that last extraction and still make some more money? And we see the same thing with our notions of morality. So we see this moral ease with which Europeans were just fine with enslaving millions of people and working them to their death for their wealth. We see that same kind of grotesque mentality in today's world, where it's hard to even comprehend, but the wealthiest six men in the world right now own as much wealth as the bottom half of the world's population, over 3.5 billion people.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So this is why it feels that the way we choose to celebrate Columbus Day can tell us so much about our civilization's future. That as long as we celebrate these values that allow us to exploit others recklessly and to view the earth as a resource to plunder, we could be headed for environmental catastrophe. But there's a lot we can learn from this viewpoint of traditional China, this recognition of the importance of using power for stability, to maintain rather than to disrupt. But we don't even have to go to Admiral Zheng to look at that. We see that here in the values and ways of living of the indigenous people who still continue their traditions here in North America and in South America. We see that in Standing Rock, where when people were fighting against these kind of extractive behaviors that were going to poison their land, they did so with these prayers of love and respect for the natural world and the importance of responsible stewardship for future generations. And we see that now in South America, where indigenous people are organizing against some of the destruction of the rainforest there. And there's actually new ideas forming in the constitution itself of places like Bolivia and Peru called Buen Vivir, which is an actual worldview coming from indigenous ways of thinking, of connectivity, that offer a different way of taking meaning from the world, leading to a different set of values than we take for granted here in mainstream thinking in the West. So, you know, we see now that many municipalities around the states have recognized this. And in Berkeley, where I come from, it's actually called Indigenous Peoples Day, as it is in many other cities and areas around the country. And that's increasing. So it kind of makes us wonder, I wonder if it would be a moment when our civilization is actually shifting its trajectory, if and when, at the federal level, it's actually a change to, rather than calling it Columbus Day and honoring these kinds of values we're talking about, if it's actually called federally Indigenous Peoples Day, and there's this kind of shift to show that there are different values that could lead us to a different place in our civilization. So I wanted to take you through this kind of talk today, and just using this kind of lens of Columbus Day as a way to kind of delve into what some of the themes of the patterning instinct are about. And it does go all the way from early hunter-gatherer times to the modern days. And so there's a lot of different areas that that it looks at. But I think one of the most important themes, actually, is the way in which traditional China did develop a very, very sophisticated and systematic way of relating to the universe that is so different from what we're used to in the West, and the one that we can learn in the West. And at the same time, I did want to make sure that nobody would sort of walk away from this talk with believing that I'm somehow kind of glorifying some earlier time, like either glorifying earlier hunter-gatherer cultures or some sort of golden age or traditional China. Every one of these societies was living their lives causing imbalances with the natural world. Even early hunter-gatherers actually as they moved tens of thousands of years ago into new continents. They thought nature was just this wonderful, giving environment, and they led to mass extinctions of megafauna, big species, North, South America, all over the world. And traditional China, with these values of stability, caused massive environmental destruction within their country. So what I think is the real lesson we can learn is that here we are in our modern world right now, where we can be more aware of what we're doing. The reason the hunter-gatherers did what they did, the reason the traditional Chinese caused such destruction of their own society, was because they didn't realize the implications of what they were doing one generation to the next until it happened, and then they had to work with it. We have that possibility. And that's why I think it's so important that the more we can understand the ways in which we as a society gain meaning from our world, and how that leads to the values that we live according to, the more we have a chance to be conscious of where we actually can take society to. So thank you for that. And then I'd be very happy to just answer any questions people have and discuss more of the themes about the book. So.
Before we get to the question, I do have a couple of things.
Right.
So you mentioned not just cherry picking, you know, before. You can't just pick it in. I think almost everybody in this room, being San Franciscans, are probably on your page on the overall thing. But I think it seems very useful to get as intelligent and as clear an idea about what history actually was like, so that we can make the best judgment towards moving towards the future that you're talking about. I'm sure you're on the same page. So one thing that you mentioned, which was a really nice, you know, linguistic aside, that in China the word for govern and care for is the same root. And I thought immediately of the British word governess, which obviously is someone who cares for people and uses the same govern thing, so that there's some there. I had a couple of questions. You know, one of the interesting things I've heard about the Portuguese use of the Potosi silver mines, I did some work down in Bolivia, was that almost all the silver went to China, and that it caused inflation in China. So maybe they didn't dig out their own silver, but they were the ones that bought all that silver that came from South America, from what I've heard. So I thought that was interesting, because that caused them problems. Maybe the basis of that gold and silver was to not have inflation in their country too. And then one other one, Admiral Zheng He, you say, I don't know how to pronounce his name. What I read, because we did a program on that a few years ago, was that the emperor decided after that huge event that he did, and he did collect some tribute from the different places, but that the reason that they didn't follow up on it is because the emperor decided that the world was not a place he wanted to interact with, and he kind of closed off his society for that world. I don't know if you know about that.
Yes. Yeah, and there are a lot of different, historians have looked at this question.
Yeah.
And a lot of them have come up with what the great historian Jared Diamond calls proximal reasons for something. So the notion is you can look at proximal reasons, meaning like what are the actual direct catalysts of this or that happened, or you can look at the deeper reasons, what sort of underlay these things. So like in Jared Diamond's case, you know, he looks at these kind of deeper reasons for some of the structures of history, which I think are brilliant. But in this case, when you look at, you can look at all kinds of things that happened in China around that time for why these expeditions stopped happening. And actually, there were these kind of power struggles between the eunuchs and the different governing structures there. And so it was one emperor, and then he died, and then another emperor came in, and all kinds of sort of complex things around that. But I think that what is important is to go to those deeper levels. Some people, when they look at those deeper levels, some historians have said, actually, this is an argument for why a fragmented place such as Europe leads to competitive and new ways of thinking, because when you have more of a monolithic place like China, if one emperor makes a decision, I won't do that, it's all over. Whereas like somebody, so they take this example, somebody like Columbus said, He spent years trying to get financing. And one principality would say, we're not interested. He went somewhere else. So it was like a little bit like somebody's trying to start up a company today. So you go to one venture capitalist, not interested, you go to the next one. Finally, you find someone. So it's the argument, that's why Europe was so dynamic, that it allowed that kind of thing rather than this sort of stagnated empire that didn't allow that. So that's more like the traditional modern historical interpretation of the reasons why. And my analysis kind of goes a level deeper than that, I believe. And it's not arguing against those things, but saying, but ultimately, what are the ways in which these two different cultures look and get meaning from their lives? What are the values that arose that led to these behaviors? And so one thing to just add to follow up on that is I wouldn't want somebody to think that the approach in my book or the things I write and care about are somehow sort of anti-Western or anti-European or saying there's something bad about the mindset that has led to this modern world we live in right now. Every one of us uses technology for so many things. Our lives are enhanced in just unbelievable ways on so many layers by the scientific revolution that came about from the same way of thinking. So we can be grateful to that in so many ways. But what I'm offering is this notion that this way of thinking right now has gotten so extreme that it's leading to this massive disequilibrium, which is leading our society to collapse. And that's where we can rebalance by learning more about these kind of values of sustainability and these values of stability, and apply those and recognize that we can actually shift our values, not to say one is bad and one is good, but how can we come up with a set of values that really can lead to flourishing for the long term? So, thank you.
All right. Questions? Who would like to ask the first question?
You know, I think a general organizing principle is that the victor always writes the history.
Mm-hmm.
And you take the Chinese and the Han, the day of the Han, where they just conquered all of mainland China, the emperor about, I think it was 2000 A.D. or something, he put Han people all through China, and he forced everybody to adhere to the Chinese way of thinking, and also Mandarin, the Chinese language. So if you gave that speech to a bunch of Vietnamese, I think they'd have a completely different reaction about how wonderful the Chinese were. It's just that we're all the same ilk. And whoever the winner is thinks that his culture should be transformed onto the loser.
Yeah, so thank you for that. And I completely agree with that statement. I think it's so profound and so important that, you know, history is the story written by the victor. And that's been true as in China as in anywhere else. And I also recognize exactly what you're saying about what the Han Dynasty did. And China's history is filled. It's filled with massacres. It's filled with all kinds of horrible events that happened, just like any other history of any large empire or civilization. And that's why I don't want anybody to take from what I'm saying some sense of that I'm trying to say that China is the sort of good place or the civilization that is better than what we've done or any of those ideas. My point is more that here we are in this place in our global history where we are looking at some very, very profound questions as to what is the future for our global civilization. There's a real possibility of collapse, a possibility of all kinds of techno singularities, and a possibility of some kind of future that could be flourishing. So my goal is more to look at the different ways in which cultures have made sense of history and say, what can we learn from one particular culture that could be of value in our going future right now? Not saying, oh, we should all give up on Western values and all become sort of quasi-Chinese. And it's also, you know, this does raise, there are some sort of critiques of what I'm saying that can arise from postmodernist theory that says, you know, actually that's a different kind of cherry picking that is and ahistorical, and to try to say, let's take this value from this culture and apply it here, is to sort of miss, all values only have meaning within the context, and so we really shouldn't do that. And my place right now as I look at this, we've got to do whatever we can to come up with a value system that leads to real human flourishing for the future. This is a dangerous, this is a desperate time, and also a potentially hopeful time for humanity. So if there's something we can learn from a culture, if we can learn from indigenous cultures or early cultures, this notion of nature as a family and us being all interconnected, and well, we could say, oh yeah, but look at the extinctions that they led to, or look at how primitive they were in this or that way, or we can kind of all our arguments against any culture to show what was wrong with them. What I'm interested in is saying what was really valuable in something like that, that we can actually adopt and integrate within our modern way of thinking to give ourselves a richer and a more flourishing way of thinking for the future. So thanks.
I was curious about what whether you'd looked at the impact of religion on this whole topic. You know, as Western
yes.
Europe had sort of took over the Western world, and they came from Christianity.
Yes. Yes, that's right. And in fact, a big theme in the book is looking at the impact of Christianity in Western thought. And Christianity is so interesting because it itself came from earlier Greek ways of thinking. One of the things I trace in the book is the rise of what we call dualism, which is this notion of a split of the cosmos, that there's actually not just one cosmos, but two. There's like the transcendent one up there, and there's the worldly one sort of down here. And humans have the same split too. We have a soul that's eternal and can't be touched, and we have the body that dies. And actually Plato and many of the ancient Greeks were the ones who first formulated this notion, this dualistic notion. And we can see Christianity is really the first dualistic cosmology that made this into a complete systematic way of understanding the world. And what's so fascinating, again, to not get sort of stuck in notions of good and bad, but something I trace is that it was actually that way of looking at the world that arose in Christianity that led to scientific thought. So we're used to nowadays thinking of the world as being like science versus religion and fundamental Christians versus rationalist scientists and stuff like that. Actually, in the early days of the scientific revolution, people like Galileo, Newton, Kepler, they believed that they were fulfilling God's destiny, that they were actually using mathematics to actually touch into the language of God. And so, in fact, I call it Christian rationalism. The way of thinking really arose only from this kind of dualistic way of thinking that Christianity inculcated. So there are some fascinating themes to see how Christianity played out in that.
It plays in with religion and Christianity. And my question is the Confucius thinking and philosophy. And did that have maybe some certain effects on the Chinese and the Asians?
Yes, it did. And really, we can think of Confucianism as pretty much as close as you'd get in China to like the state religion, if you will. Confucian thinking got to be really sort of incorporated in mainstream Chinese thought, so that for somebody to become successful, like as a bureaucrat, like in the Chinese sort of power structure, you had to learn what are called these great Confucian classics. You had to memorize them almost word for word, and you had to be able to write long essays interpreting exactly what this or that meant. So it was a big part of Chinese thought. And Confucianism was very central to that notion of stability. A core element in Confucianism was a very patriarchal element of really sort of worshiping the forefathers, and it led to a lot of the really extreme patriarchal values that we see in traditional China, and that still continue to this day. And so that's another example of where we can see things of value in traditional China. We can also see things that many of us, as we're looking at possibilities for the future right now, would not want to, you know, take on as part of that. And Confucianism, what's interesting is that it wasn't just Confucianism, but there was a another strand of Chinese thought we know as Taoism, which was much more nature-oriented and kind of against this notion of human civilization being what it's all about, but really trying to connect back with the natural world. And one of the thing I, something I look at in the book is about 1,000 years ago, during what was known as the Song Dynasty in China, by that time, Buddhism had entered into China from its birth in India and had become very central to Chinese thought. So you had these three ways of making sense of the universe, all kind of competing against each other at that time, Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism. And a group of scholars, over a couple of hundred years, it was a long period, put together what I think is one of the most amazing syntheses of thought that has ever happened in human history. And we know it nowadays by the name Neo-Confucianism, which sounds very kind of sort of academic and ivory tower or whatever. But it's this amazing consolidation of all these different ways of thinking. And it leads to ideas about how the universe works, about focusing on connectivity and a systematic way of understanding how to live according to that connectivity that relates a lot to modern systems thinkers. So what's so fascinating is a lot of what modern complexity theorists and people who look at the, at nature and life as living systems, a lot of what they're coming up with actually relate very, very closely to what you read in these traditional Song Dynasty philosophers from 1,000 years ago. So that's something else I explore in the book a little.
In your book, you you mention how unusual it was that the Proto-Indo-European group that rode horseback and were uncivilized were the influential group when major civilizations weren't so influential. Maybe people would like to hear a little bit about that.
Right, right, sure. So, you know, what's there's a section of the book where I look at the world as it was basically around about 1,000, 1,500 years B.C., so very early. And you can look at some of these great civilizations, like there's ancient Egypt, which had been around already for thousands of years. And you can look at Mesopotamia, which is the oldest civilization, even arose probably even before China. And you had the Chinese civilization. And then you had these horseback riders on the steppes. And they were called the Proto-Indo-Europeans, like we know them now by that name. And you would have looked at that point and wouldn't have even dreamed that this particular group of people could have had any influence on the future of where human thought went. But it turns out that these people had a technology that other people didn't have. They had the horse, and they used that to basically be able to establish their sort of their ways of being, their kind of pastoral lifestyles and thought processes further and further afield. They were the people who ended up going through India and invading India. And they're known as the Aryans, who became the higher castes in India. They were also the people who went into Iran. And in fact, the word Iran and similar is like the land of the Aryans, essentially. And that led to the religion of Zoroastrianism there. And they were the same people who went into ancient Greece. And there they were known as the Achaeans, who over a few hundred years were the peoples who actually created the city-states that led to the ancient Greece that we know of. So what's so fascinating there, something that very few people are aware of in these kind of cultural complexes, is when you look at traditional Indian ways of making sense of the universe and traditional Greek ways of making sense of the universe, we think of them as like totally different. Actually, they share an amazing amount. They even have some words that are similar, which relate to this notion of this dualistic senses of a sort of a spirit that's separate from the body. And the dualistic way of looking at the universe as being a kind of meaningless material universe and some abstract conception of transcendence. You see that in both cultures coming from the same source of these Proto-Indo-European horsemen. So fascinating area that I sort of go into in some depth in the book in those contrasts.
Other questions? We have time for one more after this one, too. One of the things that you address towards the end of your book is scientific thought, scientific theories, and how it's not always so scientific. And I thought that was an interesting idea to bring up. You know, people are not being as rational as the theory presents, if you want to go into an example of that.
So we're thinking in terms of...
Modern theories that people all accept but that don't really have as rational a basis or as thought out a basis as it appears.
Thank you for that. And I think that what we see a lot of the time now when we look at kind of elements of our modern worldview, there are things that we take for granted and think are basically fundamentally scientifically true. So we're told that that there's this kind of selfish gene theory, for example, which says that actually if evolution works according to selfish genes, just trying to replicate themselves from one generation to the next. And we're told that basically humans are fundamentally selfish, and that's the reason why capitalism works so well, is because it sort of harnesses this fundamental need that humans have to be look after themselves and to be selfish. And these are things that we take as kind of fundamentals in our worldview that actually when we look historically, we recognize that they came around from a particular time and place in European thinking. And in fact, modern cognitive anthropology and cognitive science, evolutionary biology, shows us that the reality of the world is very different from that. That in fact, evolution came not from some sort of each gene just fighting against each other one to try to replicate itself more aggressively, but equally important is notions of coevolution and genes and the organisms of which they're part of exist working together, reciprocating and creating ecologies and and through that creating really new ways of relating to the natural world that allowed evolution to move in the way it did. So these are some of the things that as we look at later sections of the book, we get to understand some of our assumptions that we take for granted in mainstream thinking actually don't even have a scientific basis.
I find it quite ironic that the major religious explanation with the God that's in charge of everything and the scientific one both rely totally on determinism. When you push it logically to its extreme, even though they fight with each other, they share that one cultural value that it's just totally determined. And I think as part of that, it's very interesting that because in determinism you can't really have any desires, so human beings are wiped out of their desires, but desire has to be put someplace, and it was put on our genes. And why you would imagine that the genes are all having desires to replicate and pass themselves on, rather than that we want to have desires to use our bodies, kind of a very interesting push down of an idea to a place where you really can investigate it.
Yeah, so that is so, so true and so well said. And I think that something that's so important to really get from sort of where the book takes us is this: we're so used to seeing the ways of making meaning that I talked about a little bit before as this notion of science versus religion. And so the sort of two mainstream ways of thinking are, well, either you believe in some sort of God up there and say, okay, that's what the world is driven by, is some sort of transcendent spirit there, or you kind of wipe that out and say, okay, that doesn't exist, and then you're left with this kind of meaningless world, this kind of reductionist world, if you will. And we've all heard people say, or scientists say, actually the universe is really nothing but a whole set of molecules sort of bouncing around, and that is what the universe is about. There's a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, Steven Weinberg, who basically says it, really sort of encapsulates it by saying, the more we know about the universe, the more meaningless it appears. And it seems like we're sort of stuck within these choices, and there's no other real rigorous, meaningful alternative. But something that I also explore in later parts of the book is how modern systems thinking which we some of us know about through notions like complexity theory or systems biology, or some of us have heard of chaos theory. The whole series of different scientific disciplines that actually look at the ways in which things connect up rather than the specific elemental parts of what they are. And it's every bit as rigorous as what we call reductionist science. You have tons of Nobel Prize winners, tons of peer-reviewed journals that look at this way of understanding things scientifically. But if you take the philosophical implications of this system's way of understanding the world, what it leads to is a way of recognizing ourselves as being connected, as being part of an interconnected universe, both connected within ourselves. It recognizes humans as not as being these separated individuals, but part of connected communities, and those being part connected with the natural world. And that's where I think what's so interesting is that some of these values we see from indigenous cultures, that some of the values we see from traditional Chinese thought actually relates and can infuse with more kind of traditional wisdom some of the greatest, most important new insights we're finding from modern systems thinking. And I find that so valuable because you realize we're not in this either-or place between science and religion, if you will, but there's actually a scientific way of connecting with meaning.
And the way we find that is to find the patterns, right?
Right.
But exactly. but the interesting part about that is everybody's found different patterns, and it's very hard to sort through them all and say which ones go this deep, which ones go this deep, and which ones are generalizations and which ones are truths. And obviously, with more people working on, the closer we'll get to something that actually works. But we will be right. Pursuing the patterning instinct for as long as we are around. Thank you very much for a different viewpoint on the scientific approach.
Thank you.
And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 115th year of enlightened discussion in its new building at 110 Embarcadero. Thank you very much for coming.